Live from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the Total Education Show, the talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators. Here's your host of the show, Neil Haley, the Total Tutor.
We're back to the Total Celebrity Show on the Total Education Network. Again, TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, TotalTutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley, Instagram, TotalTutor, Pinterest, Neil Haley, and Google Plus, Neil Haley. And this is a very, very interesting story, and it's a definite story of recovery and courage. I'm excited to welcome the program former Alabama football star and NFL star Keith McCants. Keith, thanks for calling, and how are you today?
I'm doing great, Neil. Thanks for having me, man. It's a pleasure.
Well, absolutely, Keith, and it's exciting to have you on the program, especially, you know, what you've gone through in your career, and to share it with our audience is awesome. But when you first started, did you always think you were going to be a football star? When you were growing up, did you think you'd be a football star?
Well, actually, what people don't know, I really was a basketball star. And that was more passionate of the thing to do than it was football. But the courses along the lines, things changed in my younger age, and I revert to football.
And then once you saw that football was your sport, you just kept working hard, right? Saw how important it was to keep practicing and put that effort in on the field, right? Even at a younger age, like in high school and stuff, you really put the effort in, didn't you?
Oh, yeah, in high school, yeah. But I think as a young child, every kid wanted to be a Lance Swan or Tony Dorsett, Joe Namath. Everybody wanted to be that imaginary superstar, not knowing what the price is paid to get there.
Right, and they don't know that. And still today, I think, Keith, the same thing. I don't think they know the price that you have to pay to get there. You know that? For sure.
No, it doesn't. That's why I'm glad you had me on, because that's one of the things that I stress and I like to talk about, is that the price you have to pay to get there. It's one thing to make it to the top. It's a totally different other thing to stay at the top. And if you want me to elaborate,
absolutely. Well, we'll get to that for sure, Keith. Trust me, I life after football. So many NFL players I've talked to, and specific things from Leon Searcy to different people that have gone through, you know, the trials and tribulations, then to life after football and that transitioning period. It's a very tough thing for sure. But so once you got you were a superstar in high school, and then why did you choose the University of Alabama? What was the reasoning for that? Yeah.
I chose the University of Alabama because of the rich tradition that the University of Alabama carried. I'm not only from there, I always was an Alabama man. And growing up, watching different players like Joe Namath, Kenny Stabler, Scott Hunter, watching those guys play at the University of Alabama, and watching Bear Bryant win national championships after national championship. You know what I'm saying? Everybody wants to be on a championship team. Now, in that, it's the SEC, and Alabama got a lot of coverage that allow you to be on national television and get known all across the world.
Definitely, and Alabama's tradition, and if you grew up there, you either pick Auburn or Alabama, right? For sure.
It's one of those two. Very few people escaped out of the state if they get that caliber player. Do you think Gary Smith would have came to Alabama and he played in Florida? They wouldn't let that happen.
Exactly, and so you were that kind of player. Never, you're not leaving, right? You're staying, you're going, and that's the important thing. You stayed there, and then by growing up an Alabama football fan, and then finally putting on the Crimson Tide, it probably was your most fondest memories of football was playing for Alabama. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes, it was. That was the best time of my life. That's when football was football, and you got a chance to play across the country. You went against different states, like Mississippi State, Ole Miss. You played against Penn State in Pennsylvania, and you played against the best of the best, and that's what it was all about.
And you were a superstar at Alabama. For our listeners out there to remember that, and your college career, you had a series of rewards, right? How many awards did you win in college? A ton. I saw
all
that list.
Yeah. All of them said the Buckers Award. I won all of them said the Buckers Award. I was the United States All-American. It's just like, I see a lot of people don't fail to realize I only played a year and a half of college football and was rated the number one player in the country. So that was the honor within itself. Nothing that I did to deserve. I get all the credit to God and to my teammates and all them that made me stand out player. But there's definitely hard work behind it.
And then when you look at all the time and effort you put in to football, and you said the price you paid, college football in Alabama is like being in an NFL, playing NFL football already, because of the tradition, because of the expectation of winning, and the whole ambiance of playing college football at Alabama. It's like playing for a professional team almost.
Well, the standards are so high there. They're used to the winning. We don't win, and we don't know. We're going for the national championship every year. Second place is not in our vocabulary. It doesn't exist. Just so happens that when you play for Alabama, you're playing among the best of the best, and you're playing with the best of the best, and the hard work and determination that go along with it. I can remember there was times that I had to get up at 3:30 in the morning, push a bronco across the campus because I didn't go to class or something that's happened. And in reality, I was building muscles and that I didn't even know I had. So when I hit the field, it was like when everybody was tired, I wasn't. I had a photograph of them. I remember the whole playbook. I knew what they was doing before they did it. That's how much we had to study. You know what I'm saying? So doing that and then typing the paper at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning to get your lesson, it was stressful, but it paid off. Hard work paid off.
So you had that great career in college. You get the opportunity to go to the NFL, first round draft pick. You were thinking the same type of story was going to happen in your NFL career, correct, Keith? That's what you were hoping for sure.
Well, I'll tell you what. When draft day came, and I got the phone calls, and I'm just keep it real with you, brother. This is a guy named by Lynn Pescarelli. NFL wanted to do a chop job. Dog is headed by what's his name? Okay, he was an Atlanta Falcons coach. They did a chop job, which had me tremendously on fire. I had a bad day. They got Kiffin and all this bad publicity out. I was a bad person, but they called it a chop job. I'll talk about that later on in another. I mean, there's something else I got going on. But the NFL is one of the most powerful organizations. They do what they want to do, when they want to do it, and how they want to do it. And there can't nobody fight them because they don't have the money to do so. And when I came to the NFL, I came to the NFL on a bad leg. And one of the coaches made the statement. The doctors did through the physical at the combine. Said McCann's got a bad leg. Said we know. He said he ain't gonna last 5 years. He said we only need him for 3. That's how much they catch your life under a microscope, buddy.
Oh my gosh! And so why was the reputation there that you weren't a good guy? Well, who was kind of getting that out there to the NFL teams and stuff at draft day?
Jerry Glanville was the head coach of the Atlanta Falcons, and Lynn Pescarelli played. He worked for the Atlanta Journal, and he was covering the story. If you do the research, you will see that he apologized later on. But the thing is, the damage was done. I lost about $7 million that day. I went from number one and number four, and that had me on steaming fire. I couldn't wait to get out there. So I had an exploratory surgery that I didn't have to have, and it just prolonged me getting out there sooner than I wanted to. And one thing led to another, injuries.
Right. So from that point, getting that reputation because of Jerry Glanville and and the opportunity that you had with such a great career, everything at your age, think about it. How old were you when you graduated from college? So you're still not able to kind of, how old were you, Keith?
20 years old.
20 years old. At 20 years old, it's very hard for anyone to be put in this kind of predicament, right, Keith? And say the right and do the right things at this point.
Especially when you don't have nobody to lead you on the way, or to tell you you need it for proper advice.
It's so true. And so you go through that process, you hear things, and as you know, look at people right nowadays that make the same types of mistakes. You didn't have the agent or somebody to say, hey, this is not true. These stories are not true. So then you get drafted and injuries come. And that's so things just keep going downhill. So your whole perspective of hard work and I'm gonna be the very best, when everything starts going wrong for you and you've not surrounded yourself with the right people, what happens, Keith?
Well, let me tell you what happened. When I got drafted, I was already had a bad leg. They didn't want to put me on the field because they knew I was already bone on bone. But then I signed the biggest NFL contract for a defensive player, they had to put me on the field. And when they put me on the field, they had to keep me on the field. In order to keep me on the field, they had to medicate me. And they medicated me, and they medicated me. And I was so young and dumb and so inspired, come from a rich university that play off of pride. Any means necessary to get me out there because of my competitiveness, not knowing the effect that it would have on me later on in life.
My gosh. And so that's terrible. So basically, they spent the money on you. They treated you like meat. They didn't treat you like a human being and said, put you on painkillers to have you do all, you know, shoot you up, get you on the field so that you don't hear it from the fans. You don't hear it from the front office saying, what are we paying Keith McCants for if he's sitting out, right? And then there you go.
That's basically how it goes. And nobody that's big, expendable, no one man bigger than the game in the National Football League. They will tell you that when you get there. No matter you're Joe Montana, Dan Marino, or Deion Sanders, or Keith McCants, or Emmitt Smith. No one person is bigger than the game itself. It's a money-making business, and it's very lucrative. It's a multi-billion-dollar organization, and ain't nobody going to go against them.
Yeah, and
Keith McCants.
Definitely.
But Keith McCants and what's the coach's name from the Raiders that died? Al Davis.
All two
people don't go against the National Football League because I stand up and I believe in what is right.
And that's important. And that's one thing I try to do, Keith, in my education is I'm an advocate for families that just don't have that advocate. I'm the advocate for educators that are not don't have that voice. And that's fantastic. You're doing that. So through that process of taking all these meds, and I know this from being a former professional wrestler, a lot of the guys I wrestled with overseas and then went on to the WWF, they were addicted to these painkillers as well. They were addicted to certain, you know, because of the pain. And then after the game's over, those pain medications wear off, Keith. What do? It's like you don't want to be in pain when you need to go train the next day, right? You don't want to be in pain when you got to go run and stay in shape, right?
Well, I'm going to tell you how it worked for me. Nobody wants to be in pain because you're learning how to deal with the pain. What they tell you is the fine line between it being injured and hurt. They knew I had bone on bone, so some teams told me I didn't even have to practice just playing the game. And this is how it goes. I was doing 185 lower tabs of Percocets with Tylenol a week with morphine shots after every game, taking the shots of cortisone and Tramadol before the game just to be out there to just go out there and play. Then 6-7 years later, Arizona comes to me and says, McCants, we're going to have to let you go. He said, you became addicted to the pill. Addicted? I'm like, what the hell is addiction? I don't know what that is. I ain't addicted to nothing. You give me a pill. And then when they kicked me out of the NFL, blackballed me out of the NFL, I'm playing on one leg. I had to have surgery on both my knees at the same time. As a man, I had 32 surgeries. Okay? So how it works is that when they kick me out, 6 months out of the year, after that, they didn't have to fend for yourself. They take your insurance away with all these pre-existing injuries. Now I got all these pre-existing injuries, and now I'm hurt. Now what I do? I can't afford. It's cheaper for me to go around the corner and get a morphine chair for $20 than to go to the hospital and get a morphine chair for $150 a shot. So I was reverted to street drugs. And when I reverted to street drugs, I got caught up in the street things that happened in the streets. And then I became lost. When I became lost, I had no idea what I was doing. I got arrested. I tried to commit suicide. I became homeless. I became dead. It was pathetic. I lost it. Then on top of that, I had 20-some concussions. I had dementia. I lived in the streets for 2 years and didn't know who I was. So they put me in different rehabs. And when they put me in different rehab, they're like, well, we don't know. We don't know what's going to happen with you. You really screwed up. You need to go to the hospital. That's on my bones and my joints and the hip replacement, knee replacement, 15 surgeries on one knee, 5 on the other shoulder. The bone came out of my shoulder against Detroit Lions. That was a compound fracture. Sam Watts makes the statement, we don't pay you X amount of money, put them back in there. And that's what they wrapped me up and put me back in there. That's what the NFL do. And Just let me speak freely for a second. I know better. I've been to so many rehabs. That last stop was at Reawakening in Miramar, Florida. Now, I'm going to tell you something. I took something from each and every rehab that I went to.
Okay.
And what I do today is that Reawakening is more like a family and hands-on-hand rehab that teach you to get the necessary things. They got things that people don't have. Dehydrated IV. They have things that is unbelievable to bring people back. I'm gonna tell you something. I was on drugs for almost 18 years. But when I came here and they started doing the thing, I recommend that any professional athlete get a second shot or give it a chance, because they did something that people don't do. They give you the will to live. They show you how to live life on life terms, and they got a good. The staff is just phenomenal. And I tell you what, I love it so much I decided to come work here.
that's a tremendous story in so many ways, Keith, because you literally hit rock bottom trying to go through this process of addiction. And you said when you were in the NFL, you were already addicted to painkillers, and just continued. So then throughout your career and then life after football, the same thing happened. You needed truly people that cared for you, right, Keith? When you go through these other rehab centers, they do care in some ways, but yet you see some specific connection to this group in general that now you want to work for them because you see what they were able to take you and see you as a person and really believe in you. Because a lot of people don't believe in people that are addicted, right, Keith?
No, they don't. Let me tell you something. Well, I've got one thing that I have. I lost all my money. I lost everyone. The money went to friends with the friends with the ex-wife, man. Everything gone. The only thing I got to stand on is the truth, buddy. And one thing that I love giving back is unconditionally is my experience, my strength, and my hope. I've been to 18 different rehabs. I'm going to tell you, this place here is phenomenal. I would have worked here for free. Because they give them the opportunity to do free range and stuff like that. It's so many that the world of the disease of addiction, it is affecting our kids is worldwide, and it is so important. A lot of kids are dying. I had a son, my son, he had two friends that died last month, ODing. If I don't step out and try to do something about it, who will?
No one's going to. And so you see your second chance in life, Keith. Now you want to help others. You want to navigate through people that are dealing with addiction and how you are able to recover. And then you're also looking at what I brought up at the beginning, the NFL star, the new NFL star that doesn't understand the price they're paying to be a star. And understand specifically how to navigate so they're ready when it's life after football. Because I'm sure it was really tough, Keith, after even your NFL career. You still had 6 years. You still got to play against some unbelievable competition in your career. And then, wham, it was over. And
it's over with. And I'm going to tell you something else. What drives me to do the things that I'm doing, I had people like Junior Seau, a good friend of mine. I went fourth, he went fifth. Bobby Futrez to kill himself. Kevin McHale from Brooklyn to kill himself. All drugs, Andre Waters to kill himself. I'm doing it for the guys who can't do that for themselves. I'm doing it for those people out there who already is in the grave. I'm doing it for those people that headed to the grave. I'm going to tell you something. It's a big challenge and it's a big step. And I thank Reawakening for giving me the opportunity to give me the floor to speak about it worldwide.
Well, and I'm happy that I've gotten the opportunity to interview as well, and I'm going to be praying for you, Keith. I'm going to be praying for you to continue to recover and that you make a difference. And always God is able to come up with to make you the instrument. You had your career, you had your success, you had your falling, but now you're making that comeback so that you can help others and people that did die, and so that their death isn't, so that you can speak out. And speaking out against the NFL, what have you gotten response from the NFL from some of the comments you're making about how you were treated when you played for the Buccaneers and the other NFL teams?
All the response I got back is when my book is coming out, because I think they're afraid of how popular, how fire's going to be, because I'm based on power. You're talking to a guy who tried to commit suicide three times. What has that got to lose? Okay? So when I speak, I tell the truth about everything. And the truth will set me free. And I stand on it. And I dare anybody to go against what I said because I can prove it.
Well, I think you can prove it, and it's use and abuse. Again, the big in professional sports and even entertainment, they you have your run, then you're forgotten, and that's sad. And then you see the specific people with the head injuries and the different things or the addictions and how many NFL players or the former NFL players that are broken and have shortened lives, and the NFL needs to do something about it. They need to have a better pension for you guys. They need to be able to mentor you more after your career is over, because you made so much money for them and so much money for the organizations, the owners, and the NFL in general. And I'm glad you're definitely speaking out about that stuff for sure, Keith. When do you think your book's going to come out? Do you have an idea when that's going to happen?
Well, I tell you, the book has already been wrote. We're working on some kinks and hangers on it, and I'm working with Reawakening with it, the people in the communication department, because we want to get all our facts together and all straight, because it's going to be a true story. I tell you what, it's so good. They already talking about making a movie out of it. That's how good it is.
Well, I'm glad I'm one of the first people to get an interview with you, and we'll definitely have you back, Keith, when the book comes out. We'll stay in touch. Is there a place you can find information on you, Keith? Is it best just to Google some of the stuff I posted on the link on my website, your New York Times interview? I mean, and so people can read about, you know, your career in that article. But is there other places they can find info on you, Keith?
Yeah, you know, sometimes it's like this. When I left the NFL and I was out there hooked on drugs doing any and everything, you want to go find out what your purpose is. My purpose is to reach out and touch different people around the country that can't help themselves and that don't know how to ask for help. And one of the things that teach you at Reawakening is that we love on you until you start to love yourself. And the most important thing is that people forgive. They forgive everybody else, but the hardest thing in the world to do is forgive yourself. And that's what we teach you. That's what
90 seconds.
Well, absolutely. Well, that's great talking to you. So is there a website for the organization you're working for to find info on?
It's called reawakeningwellness.com.
All right. Well, fantastic. And we could just Google you, right, Keith? There's no you have not a website or anything yet till the book's out, right?
Right. Yeah. You Google reawakeningwellnesscenter.com. And I'm starting to link myself with these guys. Because I think we do some big things together.
All right, well, Keith, good talking to you. God bless, man, and I'm best of luck on all your ventures. And I know that you're going to truly make a great difference. And I hope they make a movie out of this. And I'm happy to know you, and I had a good conversation. So thanks again for calling, Keith. Hi, we're live, the Total Celebrity Show, Total Education Network, TotalTutor.net for more information, Twitter, TotalTutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley, Instagram, TotalTutor, Pinterest, Neil Haley, Google+, Neil Haley, and all those different places. And I'm excited to welcome the program Florida State star, former NFL star, Henry Crockett. Henry, thanks for calling, man, and thanks for stopping by the studio today. How are you?
Doing good, guys. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it, man.
Absolutely. And Henry, did you always think that you were going to be an NFL star? Growing up, did you think that was going to happen?
No, not really. When I was young, man, I used to be on the Charlotte basketball team with Eddie Jones. I had aspirations of being an NBA player, but it didn't work out that way. I was kind of tall when I was young, so I started growing out, which was sort of upward. So football made more sense.
and so when you finally figured that out, it was how old were you when you said, hey, football is where I'm going to, it's not going to be basketball?
Yeah, I kind of figured it out by default. You know, I just started playing with my brother, Zach. You know, Zach had been playing since he was 8 years old. So I just went out with him a couple of times, and he told me about tour days. But I thought he said a tour. I thought we was going on a tour, and I was kind of excited about that. And I was like, well, once I got there, I thought we was going on a tour. He said, no, tour days. So I was like, oh, shit. So my brother's always one of those guys that if you start something, you got to finish it. So I was trying to stop. And he was like, no, you started, you got to finish. So if you don't like it by the end of the year, then you ain't got to play no more, but you got to finish this year out. And so I just fell into playing linebacker, man. I just loved it. So by the end of the year, man, my sophomore year in high school, I was All-American, so kind of stuck with it.
you definitely did kind of stick with it, and then you saw, hey, this is where you're going to be going. And then choosing Florida State, was that a difficult decision growing, I guess, growing up in Florida, that you're going to pick FSU to go to?
You know, it was very difficult for me because I didn't really want to go to Florida State at the time because my idol was Canadian Bennett. I wanted to go to Alabama. And then my mom, she was like, no, I don't really like Alabama. Then my mom was a Christian, so she liked, because Mike McCartney was in Colorado, so I was going to go to Colorado. And she didn't like Colorado because I was too far. And my next choice was Oklahoma. Because I was a big linebacker, and you know, those guys really had a good linebacker core. So it came down to Alabama. They took me to Barry Switzer House, lined and dialed me. Barry Switzer showed me all the big case, all the rings in the house.
Wow.
I was trying to deliver, man. I was going to Oklahoma. My mom missed that idea. She said, nope. My brother Zach was already at Florida State. I think it'd be better if you go there. You guys have each other. So that's how I ended up at Florida State.
Well, I guess I'm glad. I think you're glad from the mentoring of Bobby Bowden and stuff that you chose Florida State later on, right? For sure.
You know, more important, Bowden was great, but more important, man, we had guys like Marvin Jones. We had Derrick Brooks. Derrick Brooks ended up being my mentor.
Okay.
We had a great linebacker core. Derrick Brooks, Marvin Jones, Sam Coward. Man, we had tons of linebackers, you know. So, you know, it was very competitive, and guys had formed a real brotherhood. So that was the best time. That was the best thing about that at Florida State, the closeness that we had. And to this day, we still are really good friends. Derrick Brooks, Santa Cal, Marvin Jones, we all talk at least once or twice a month. So, you know, that's the best thing about Florida State for me.
And is it a university you still pay attention to what's going on at Florida State, it being your alma mater and stuff?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for me, I'm more of a fan now. I'm a booster at Florida State, so I got season tickets for the family. So I go out a couple games a year. I always go sit down with Jimbo and see what's going on. Jimbo's great. He opened the doors for us, and especially for me when I come up, I got an open door policy. I come out, and just walk into his office, talk with him. So I still have a great relationship at Florida State and very involved.
What would you say, and we're definitely going to get to the foundation pretty soon in life after football and then the foundation, what would you say was your greatest moment in college? What would you say, what game, is there a specific game you could tell us about?
For me, I always had, it was so competitive, so I only really started one year. It was always splitting time. And we were playing Notre Dame in the Orange Bowl, and it was actually my brother's rookie year. And they were playing San Diego in the playoffs, and we was in the Orange Bowl for the bowl game. And I just remember, feeling I was going to have a good game. I was in the hotel watching my brother, Zach, at the Cal Indianapolis Colts play against San Diego. Man, he had just bust off like a 50-yard touchdown and came back and had about a 70-yard. I'm like, oh, man. And so that was one of the funnest days. I go out and got MVP for our Orange Bowl team. You know, I had a couple sacks, fumble coverage, and all that stuff, interceptions in the Orange Bowl. So that was one of my funnest memories, like really. And that was like my coming out game that set me up for my senior year. So I remember that because both me and my brother had success that day.
That's great. And did you guys win the national championship when you played for Florida State? I didn't check back. Did you win the national championship when you played for Florida State? What was the closest?
I won my sophomore year in 1993. We beat Nebraska. That was a great game. It was a very good defensive game because they had the black shirt defense with Nebraska, Trail Alvarez, and all those guys. So it was a lot of unbelievable defensive talent on that field that day. It was just like a defensive struggle. So I remember that. That was a great game. Wasn't too big for me because I was running down on special teams. But it was like it was a lot of – because even when we thought we won the game, they gave Nebraska another shot to kick a field goal because, I forgot somebody got a personal foul and, the time they run out. So we go from thinking the game is over, we're national champs. So now Nebraska got an opportunity to kick a field goal to win the national championship. And for Miami, we always get these wide right. And then just after we won our national championship on the wide right by Nebraska. So, you know, that was a lot of fun memories, man. So, it was great. Every year playing a huge bowl, you know.
Yeah.
So it was awesome.
Yeah, and you can always say you're a national champion and you were one game away from being a Super Bowl champion. So what a great way when you're talking to kids about that, and we'll get to that very, very soon. So once you get to the NFL, what were your goals and aspirations once you got to the NFL?
So when I got to Atlanta, you know, Atlanta wasn't a good team. No one came to the games. It was just like, and I remember, and you know, Derrick Brooks was telling me, "Hey, listen, it ain't like Florida State where we come out that tunnel, man. You got 100,000 fans going crazy, you know, because Tampa wasn't good either. So he said you have to get yourself going. You know, Derrick Brooks was telling me that, and I remember my rookie year, I was looking around, I was like, man, you know what? I only lost four. I registered at Florida State. I only lost four games in 5 years. So I wasn't used to losing. And the guy was trying to get me to accept the idea, hey, man, it's a job. It ain't like college. And you're going to lose games. Don't take it to heart. I was like, screw that. We're going to turn this around, man. So I remember, like, my first 10 games we lost. And by 11 games, we won the last five games. And from that point, we went 21-2. Going into the next year. That's the year we made it to the Super Bowl, and I was fortunate enough to play the Super Bowl in my hometown down here in Miami in my second year. So that was one of my fondest memories, actually being a part of, like, coming in with a new coach, Dan Reeves being a new coach, and really turning the Atlanta Falcons around. When they called us the Dirty Birds, now I look at the stadium now when I go back to the games for the Falcons, how crazy it is and how loud it is. It's like a club. It's like they got great fans. But, you know, it wasn't always like that. You know, and I like to take pride in saying that, you know, I was part of the group that turned that team around.
Yeah, and so and you definitely did. And to get to that Super Bowl and almost be there, and it's amazing. It definitely is, and it's definitely a fond memory. Would you say did getting to the Super Bowl, being in that NFC Championship game, would you say that was one of your fondest memories with the Falcons?
Yeah, it was amazing because that's the year they had the greatest show on turf. Not greatest show on turf, but that's when Minnesota had Randy Moss's rookie year, and they came in,
yes,
and they were putting up numbers like, please. And I remember watching film, and Tampa gave us the blueprint that year to beating Minnesota. I remember saying, if we can just weather the storm, they're going to come out, they're going to jump out and put 21 points on us quick. If we just weather the storm, we'll beat these guys. We just got to tell, we can't just lose focus after they put those 21 points up. And lo and behold, just like we thought, they came out and jumped out on us like 21 points. Moss got two touchdowns quick. So we just stayed together, and they slowly but surely started breaking down, making mental mistakes, breaking down. And they weren't used to playing 4-4 quarters. Most of the time, by third quarter, Randy Moss got his shoulder pads on button. Chris Carter got his shoulder pads on button. Robert Smith on the sideline. So we forced them to play four quarters, and they wasn't ready for that. They weren't built that way. So I was one of the greatest games I ever played. And plus, that was the first time I ever saw snow. So some of the guys, like O.J. Santiago, he's from Canada. He was like, man, we got to go out and make some snowballs so you can see some snow, man. So that was my first time. So, because in Florida State, if you're from up north, we give you $1 million, tell you to come down and play us at the Citrus Bowl in Orlando. So we never really played up north.
Yeah. So you were just seeing that, and you're saying, wow, the snow, and getting used to that for sure. Then after you went to the Falcons, you had a couple more years. You ended up playing for the who else did you play for? You played for the Broncos, right? You played 1 year with the Broncos?
Yeah. It's funny. It never happened. I signed a 1 year free agency deal with the Broncos because the matter was, they, at that point, they were strapped for cash. They were playing hardball. So I went there. So before training camp started, Dan Reed gave up two draft picks to bring me back to Atlanta. So I never had a chance to play with Denver. So it never happened. Like they didn't. I remember going to the office with the Broncos, and they didn't know what to do. They didn't know how to do the paperwork, or it had never happened before. So I ended up getting traded back to Atlanta for two more years, and then I signed a free agent deal with Minnesota, and I did 3 years in Minnesota and finished up there.
And then life after football, Henry, that's got to be tough. You know, finally, did you have focus to understand your brother playing in the NFL? Did that help as well in the process of looking and focusing in on life after football?
You know what really helped me with life after football? I tell you, I was a Canadian Bennett idol. It was my idol growing up. And I was fortunate enough to end up playing with Canadian Bennett for a couple of years in Atlanta. And he embedded in me as a youngster to, like, always open your own doors, carry your own luggage, treat everybody with respect, because right now you're on the high. You're going to be the same people that you meet. When the lights turn off in the NFL, they turn off quick. They're going to be the same people you meet on the way down. So I always treat people with respect. And if somebody asks me to do something, it's never about money. Come speak to this kid. I go speak to that kid. Oh, come talk to this group of kids. I go talk to the group of kids. It wasn't about money. It was just about building a relationship. And those same relationships I built throughout my career in the NFL are the same ones I lean on today. And that's one of the best things I ever did. Canadian Bennett gave me some of the best advice. He's been my mentor ever since I was a rookie. He's still to this day, anything I have, Canadian Bennett shows up to it. And he's still mentoring me to this day. And I think that's what the NFL is missing. You know,
right, exactly.
They're missing the veteran leadership in those locker rooms because, you know, these owners don't put a lot on having veterans in the locker room. Which I blows my mind. If you're giving these young guys all this money, you're investing in these young guys, you need somebody in that locker room that can reach these guys to show them the right way to do things. But you know what? They don't have them no more. We call the babies raising babies in these locker rooms. You're expecting these guys to go out and make great decisions. All the way they learn by trial and error, by making mistakes.
Right.
Because there's no one there that is saying, hey, this is the way to do this. When I was there, Canadian Smith, Jesse Tuttle, Dana Brand, those guys said, hey, we wear suits to every game. I don't care what anyone else is doing on the team.
Right.
You get on this bus, you wearing a suit and tie because it's a business trip.
And you were saying Dan Reeves, correct? That was Dan, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was Dan Reeves. But it didn't even get to Dan Reeves. Canadian Smith set the tone. And I knew how things were going to be run. If it got the Dan Reeves, more likely you didn't cut.
Right.
Like those guys, those veteran guys dealt with everything in the locker room. So you don't have that veteran leadership anymore. I mean, they're calling guys 4 or 5 years veterans now. When I was 4 or 5 years, you still a baby.
Right.
So I think the biggest problem in the NFL they need to reevaluate is that veteran minimum. The veteran minimum has forced a lot of veterans out of the NFL.
Right.
I remember my rookie, go ahead.
I was going to say, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the thing is, it's all about money. And it's all about, you know, if you're not the biggest superstar in the salary, you're a salary cap casualty, they're going to find somebody else that's going to go for half that pay or three quarters that pay. And it's all about cap. It's not about the best players on the field all the time, for sure.
Yep. And people wonder why, like, teams like Pittsburgh and New England and those guys are consistent. They're consistent. You know, they keep finding older guys because they understand the importance of having that veteran leadership in the locker room. You can't be around these guys all the time. These guys, these young guys, they know the league. They know the guys that's really putting in work in this league. And you keep those guys on that team, they respect them. Look at Pittsburgh, how they brought back the linebacker. What is his name?
Harrison, right? Yeah. Was it?
Yeah.
No. Yeah, James Harrison. Yeah. Yeah, James Harrison, yeah.
I'm sure they could have got somebody, a younger guy that was cheaper or, you know, more upside. But you know what? They brought a guy back that was good for the locker room, the guy that had a great work ethic, and that showed guys how to be a professional. He's a constant professional. So it's so important to have those type guys on your team, and I think that's what the NFL is going wrong, that it was a lot of that when we played, and when I played in the NFL, now it's all gone. So it's a little bit frustrating to watch a lot of these guys make mistakes, to understand why. And I'm just fortunate enough to be able to come in an era where the head coaches believe in veterans and respect the veteran leadership. And I think that's a lot to do with me giving back, me starting that foundation, giving back to the community, because I want to try and get these kids that have aspirations of making it to the NFL or even just going to college, getting them a heads up and say, hey, this is how you do these things.
So true. Today, yeah, definitely, Henry. And thinking about that is that you saw that what you were doing during your football career started the foundation, and you were the kind of guy that said, you know, in life after football, I'm going to help these kids. I'm going to talk to these kids. I'm going to say, don't make the mistakes that so many guys make in their careers, in life. They choose the wrong path. Even if they were a superstar in the NFL, a lot of them are broke. A lot of them made the wrong decisions. I'm here to mentor you and help you through this process, right?
Yep. And even with that, like, it goes back to Derrick Brooks. I learned Derrick Brooks first started his foundation. I assisted. I got the Falcons to work with Six Flags to give his kid free tickets to Six Flags. And he brought those kids up from Tampa for their first trip to Tampa, and they learned about the Martin Luther King. And they went to Six Flags, and I volunteered. I went on the trip with them, and I was really inspired because in my life I had a person like Dr. Canero that who invested in me. So that's how the Carter Foundation was started there very next year in 1998, and we adopted 26 games, and we 26 kids. We had kids at the games every week, every Tuesday I'd be there, every Tuesday mentoring his kid, working with them. But I stayed with those kids till they graduated from college. And now since I retired, I'm back at home. And we got our own programs. We work with kids on the ABCs called attendance, behavior, and curriculum. Because we believe we can get a kid to show up. His behavior changed. Once his behavior changed, his course, which is considered his grade, his grades change.
Yes.
And that's what the foundation built on, making sure these kids reach their full potential and preparing them for society. We want all these kids not just to be great athletes,
right.
We want them to be great citizens. So that's what my brother's trying to do, you know?
I'm glad you brought that up, Henry. There's a lot of guys out there that are adults that are mentoring these kids, and yet they're looking at dollar signs. At one point, they're going to make it, okay? They're looking at, these are the kids I'm going to mentor, and these are the kids I want. They're going to be the next 5-star, 4-star, so I can be, when they sign that NFL contract, I can be there at the games watching them say, hey, I was the one that made them. You're looking at, Henry, at life as men, mentoring them so that they become great men, not superstars. I mean, you're going to help them in that process if they have that ability, but you're looking at, you know, and I know, even though you're a superstar on the field, that doesn't mean you're going to be a superstar in life.
Yeah, but God, and let's face it, how many of these guys are really going to be the next LeBron James or next Ray Lewis?
Not many.
If we're lucky, we might see one or two more in our lifetime. But you know what? They all can be doctors, the next doctor, the next lawyer, the next architect, the next engineer. They all can do that. So let's just work on building from that standpoint. That you all can do this. So let's find out what you're good at. Let's find out what you like, and let's expand on that. But at the end of the day, let's make sure that you're an even better person. Because what people fail to realize, life is about relationships.
Yes.
Especially when you lead this football game, it's all about relationships and how you treat people along the way. Anybody can treat people nice when it's going good. Well, when your name is not as big, how do you treat? What type of person are you? You know what I mean? What kind of relationships are you laid out and made throughout that way? So you know, we talk to kids about life and making good decisions. The importance of making great decisions and how those decisions affect your life. And, you know, me and my brother, man, something that we're passionate about. We love it. I enjoy it. It's what I do on a day-to-day basis. And, you know, just finding ways to get back to the younger community.
Henry, when I was thinking about this, you and Justice Allen Page have that type of idea and thought process of getting kids to college. A lot of foundations don't have that ultimate goal. You know and I know, Henry, if you get them to college, they graduate and you give them the tools necessary to get to college, they're going to change the whole generational lifestyle of their families and families after that.
Without a doubt.
And
that's what I impose on them.
And that's
you
phenomenal.
Don't have to be,
without
a doubt, you don't have to be an A student. You can be a C, B student. You know, but you will change the landscape of your family. And we want to expose the kids. And the kids that go out, go on these college tours. We put together college tours so they can go out and expose them to everything that's out there. And once they see how big the world is, it motivates them. You know what I mean? So our goal is, man, to keep trying to motivate these kids, keep trying to open doors for them to go through and let them know there's a whole lot of ways to make a lot of money, man.
There is.
Football and basketball is not the only way.
And the bottom line is you go to the right school, you make the right connections, you are going to be successful in life. And if you have a work ethic and you truly have high expectations for yourself and are not willing to give up,
yep.
That's phenomenal. And Henry, I really have to commend you because a lot of guys, you know, they start foundations and yet they don't have a real what's the end result. You have the end result. And I'm very, very, very glad to have learned this from you because a lot of guys I've interviewed in their foundations. And guess what? They don't have an end result. And that's the biggest problem for sure.
Yeah. And the great thing about it, because they don't work it. I encourage all these athletes, don't just put your name on something. It's important you go work these foundations. It's important the kids know you personally. So if they see you at a mall store, they can walk up to you like they know you, give you a hug, and not be afraid to speak. They really don't know you. They're part of your program, but they don't know you. And that's the thing I always want to build a foundation on, that these kids genuinely know me. They can see me anywhere. I'm like, hey, Mr. Clark, me and my brother give us a hug and just talk to her. I can ask them how was their day. Versus, like, these guys having these foundations and they sponsoring these kids. And the kids came in the mall and came and said hello.
Yes, absolutely.
So I challenge these guys, man, don't just put your name on it, man. You know, come in and work it, you know. Work this foundation, man. Put your imprint on it. Make sure it's what you really wanted to be and not somebody else's idea.
Well, Henry, that's tremendous, and I commend you for sure. Where's the best place we can find information on you? So if people want to donate, any new events you want to promote that are coming up, Henry, with your foundation and stuff, tell us about that.
Yeah, foundation, go get more information from the foundation at CrockettFoundation.org. We also have an event coming up in Lighthouse Point at Papa Hughes. It's right next to the Seafood World. I've been there for a long time. Troy is the owner, another Florida State grad, and another guy's name is Jay. They really took it upon themselves to really get behind our foundation and put this great event on. It's called Love for Literacy, and it's on July 18th from 6 to 10 p.m. at Papa Hughes in Lighthouse Point. Come out, support it, have a good time. It's a fundraiser that it goes towards our STEM program that we are in partnership with United Way and Community Foundation to help support our programs that we have throughout the year.
Well, you're doing some tremendous work. Anytime, feel free to reach out to me, Henry, you're promoting an event.
90 seconds.
You're doing some great things, man, and thanks again for calling.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
All right, take care. All right, see you later. Okay, bye-bye. You're listening to Total Celebrity Show, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to Total Celebrity Show on the Total Education Network again. TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, TotalTutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley, Instagram, TotalTutor, Pinterest, Neil Haley, and Google Plus, Neil Haley. And let the interesting celebrity interviews continue. And the Davin Joseph segment, which always gets great feedback, but I'm really excited to talk to him today because I thought, let's put him on the spot and talk about his education, meaning what teachers really made a difference in his life, and from college to high school to elementary school, what are his favorite subjects? Something that I would love to have a segment all the time just to talk education. So I'm excited to welcome the program Pro Bowler Davin Joseph. Davin, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you doing today?
Good. I'm putting you on the spot today, Davin, to talk about your days in school and your favorite subjects and all these different things. When I interview some of these younger celebrities, meaning the ones, you know, that are like on TV shows today and they're still being homeschooled or in the classroom at 16, 15 that are on, you know, major films. I always ask these questions. I thought, well, let's try this with somebody that and see what they remember. What would you say who was one of your favorite teachers of all time, Davin? I'm putting you on the spot right off the bat.
Oh, man, my favorite teacher of all time is Mrs. Spring. She was my high school PE teacher and health teacher, high school health and PE teacher. And she was just a great resource, a great mentor, a great resource for just advice always just the most gentle person, nicest person ever, that really was about seeing people prosper and grow. And so still a friend of mine today. And, you know, she's just always been such a great woman, great teacher, great mentor.
Wow. Wow. And what do you think made you in a lot of ways? And what year was that teacher you remembered? What grade was that? That teacher that you...
That was in ninth grade until 12th grade.
Ninth until...
My relationship with her and then on into college and also into pros.
So she really wanted to take an interest in students' lives then, really looked at developing them and helping them through that process, it sounds like.
I think, you know, it wasn't necessarily, it was kind of like what she was trying to do. It was just she was good at doing it. And so it wasn't like something where she tried to make it seem like you got to go through me if you want success. It was more of I'm here if you need me, but I want to just tell you the truth kind of thing, you know? And so that's what made her a great resource, because it wasn't like there was any kind of agenda behind it. Just genuinely just wanted to be a person that just wanted to help people, and not necessarily just athletes.
Oh, that's tremendous. And that's something that stuck with you, right? And helped you in that process of going on to college and choosing the university and going through that. Would you say in the younger grades, what other teacher would you bring up in maybe elementary school?
Yeah. You know, it would be my coaches. So I had Coach Held and Coach Pearson and also Coach Jackson. That were the ones that really were, and Coach Wood, also, he was my football coach the entire time I was there in high school. And so, of course, you know, the relationship between a player and a coach is always, you know, a special relationship, especially when you get, you know, we work together for a number of years. But they were also my teachers. So it wasn't just seeing them on the field, but it was also off the field. And they were holding me accountable on and off the field. And so, but it was a great relationship, because I always knew that they had my best interest in mind. And so, and like I said, those like with Miss Spring, those relationships are still today.
That's fantastic. And what do you think that those football coaches that got you to really connect with them? Because I'm sure you had a lot of coaches in your career. What special quality would you say those guys had?
That's a great question. I think the difference was, you know, it's just like everybody can have friends, but then of course you have friends that you really feel closer to because you have more in common. And I think that's what it is with those coaches, that we have a lot in common, you know, other than just, you know, football or whatever sport that I met these coaches through, which Coach Hill was my wrestling coach. Coach Wood was my football coach. Coach Pearson was my football coach. Coach Jackson was a track coach. And so it's just that you have more in common than just athletic. And so after a while, you really just form a friendship that's based upon, you know, what type of person you are and what type of people you are and how you interact. And so that's what was the main difference between kind of having a coach to tell me how to play football and having a coach that's really my friend. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Don't you think it's when you're talking about that mentorship of coaching, that the coach really has to look at the entire athlete, not just the one that's going to win the game or perform on the field, but the entire package? Because a lot of times there are guys out there now that are just focusing on either the dollar signs in training people or getting them ready for sports or coaching or winning, and not that important tangible thing that they need, which is mentorship.
Exactly. And I think right now we're having too many coaches, too many players, former players, coaches, whatever you want to categorize them as, that are trying to make money off of the backs of players, that are more interested in just star athletes and kind of what they can get from the whole deal, rather than it's more about what you give and not what you get. And it seems like most people are out with agendas and motives to get something from athletes once they make it.
Yeah.
They're making the best for these athletes with the wrong intentions in mind rather than help. It's about a return on their investment rather than just investing in players because it's the right thing to do.
Absolutely. Okay, we're talking into NFL pro Davin Joseph. Now I'm going to put him on the spot about school. Did you enjoy school in elementary school, Davin? Was school an something you couldn't wait, or you couldn't wait to get on the field after?
I think everybody. I think everybody enjoyed elementary school. Oh, high school was fun. Middle school was interesting. College was a grind, and now grad school is awesome.
That's when I heard I couldn't have you on the show because you were in class and I didn't even know about that. We were going to speak of that, Davin, but we got to go into really quickly. Elementary, would you say education was important to you? Was it something that you were intrinsically motivated to do, let's say, in middle school and high school?
You know, I had a wonderful big brother. So he made school easy for me. So basically, he would go to school and teach me everything that he learned at school. So when I went to school, I really didn't have to learn anything. And so because he was a great student, he made me a great student. So that was growing up for me. I went to school, but I had a wonderful teacher at home. And so high school, you know, elementary school, middle school, high school was all taught to me basically at home and reinforced at school. And so going through that, education was always important, but it kind of came easy because I had a great resource at home. And then moving on to college, had a wonderful foundation built to help me, you know, get through college, through that grind of playing football and also playing sports. Being able to understand things on that college level while I was in high school was, you know, sports was important, and it helped me transition from high school to college.
Definitely. And so once you got to college, this is something that I think a lot of young athletes listening need to know. And also I think that people that, you know, frequent college football games all the time and don't think of the student athlete. Once you got to college, how much of that was part of this, Davin, and that kind of you had all the training, you had to do all the different things, all, you know, maneuver through all the rigmarole, and then you had to go to class, you had to study, and you had to manage all that time when you maybe didn't have to do as much of that in high school.
In high school, I didn't have to invest as much time into studying, reading, and of course, practicing football. So I didn't have as much vested time. So of course you had, you know, more free time in high school stuff. But going into college, the free time comes, you know, far between. It is, you know, very intense when it comes to the classroom. It's very intense on the field. And you have high expectations. It's really only for the complete student athlete. And that's why it is so hard to make it as a student athlete, because you really have to have both. You gotta have the balance. You gotta have the time management. And you gotta be talented on both sides. You gotta be talented in the classroom. You gotta be talented on the field. And it's tough.
Yeah, definitely. It's tough, and I could see that you're a mentor for them, for sure, with going back to grad school, your foundation, that you can talk to a lot of these young guys and give them the support that they need, especially in an early part of their career of after football, for sure, because I could see that focus is laser focused to once you do retire, when it does come time, you're ready to roll into the next aspect of your life.
That is the goal. That is the goal. Easier said than done. But, of course, anybody, you know, not just ball players, but athletes or even students that want to grow and learn and whatnot, I want to be an example for them. And I also want to be a resource for them. And so you're right. It could be an awesome transition. But I think being a mentor would be an awesome deal.
And you have to do it, Davin. You're making the right decisions already. You are held accountable in a lot of ways for yourself to say, I need to help these guys, because you see the young athlete, the new athlete, and you see it even in your foundation. You see the new athlete and say, hey, please do not do.